to get back to what you was talking about with which side has Jews or whatever, and I want to talk about Putin's speech there for a second. Mark alluded to it about how great it was, but there was something I saw when I was listening to it. I mean, I was listening to the interpretation or the translation of it or whatever, but he was coming with some BLM talking points. He was coming with some, like, you know, colonization and all this stuff. It sounded really bitter about, you know, the sins of the West and all that stuff. And it really sounded like he was auditioning to, like, the powers that be on the globe. Like, hey, we can do the globalist thing better than the West can. Russia can take the mantle for globalism, be the new stage for global homogeneity or whatever. So it was the whole, like, the entire like moral framing of it was the exact same that we get from the regime in the West, except it was just coming out of Vladimir Putin's lips. You know, he said some things about transgenders and all that stuff, but that's really low-hanging fruit. That's like conservatives in the West saying, oh, woke, this woke stuff's getting out of control. That's basically all he was saying, you know. But then he went on to talk about, like, he was mouthing BLM talking points. He wasn't saying anything like really based. He was just saying, like, you know, typical conservative stuff. So it's still the same Nuremberg moral paradigm.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. And this is a feature of Russian propaganda from the communist period. This is the KGB playbook. They demand that the West uphold to the nth degree its most dysfunctional, destructive ideas, you know, liberalism and so forth. Because why? They want to make us worse off. That's the pattern here. This is also the pattern with Iranian anti-American propaganda. They take the sides of the oppressed black people, and it's the BLM stuff. Why do they reinforce that message? Because they want to hurt America. There was a great thing that I saw on Telegram where it was a comparison of Russia Today messaging about transgenderism. Isn't it interesting that, given that transgenderism is an absolutely insane dogma in America, Russia Today publishes stuff about people who regret transitioning. But in countries in Latin America where the trans stuff is looked down upon, Russia is publishing stuff about, oh, the poor trannies need gender-affirming care. Why are they doing this? They're basically promoting ideas that destabilize everything. They'll promote opposite ideas as long as they are destructive and destabilizing. That's the behavior of a cancerous society that is just out to exalt itself at the expense of creating chaos and destruction in the rest of the world. That's a cancer on the planet. And this is very much the pattern that you find in Soviet propaganda as well. They want to destabilize everything that they don't control, and they will grab any principle, any claim, or the opposite if it serves that purpose, which is why I'm so cynical about these pretexts that have been put forward about the war, the Donbass genocide, NATO encroachment. You know, you can debate these things back and forth as if they're offered in good faith, but in the end, these are disposable pretexts, and they would have come up with another pretext if these pretexts were denied them. So anyway, most human beings, I think, are too nice. Certainly I am. It's very, very far from my mind to consider the fact that a person who's speaking to me might be just lying to me to get something out of me. You know,
that's the disease of Northwestern Europeans.
Yeah, I want to believe the best about people and give them the benefit of the doubt. And the idea that somebody can walk up to you and just tell you bullshit because they want to harm you, it's a possibility. I know it happens, but my mind revolts against it, right? My mind just revolts against that prospect, but it's really real.
I guess it's like the when you've been selected for the essentially hothouse of Northwestern European society, something I don't think that Westerners understand just how much deception, just common everyday deception there is in Eastern and Southern societies. I don't want to get all Nordicist, but there is definitely a difference between outer and inner Hainallians. Hainallians. I don't know how you pronounce that. It's Hungarian.
Hainall. But it's
there is a difference behaviorally in how we treat truth and speech, whether we treat it as communication or weapon. But I want to disagree with you about Russia being insincere about the non-white and anti-white stuff. Because, and maybe this is not a perfect analog, but I do follow Serbian internal discourse. And you can reliably translate most of it into the Russian context, because they are of a kind. You can really treat Serbia like a smaller version of Russia in certain respects. In others, completely not. But in this respect, I think they are similar. Did you know that there is a minority of Serbs, and it's not a small percentage, but maybe 5-7% of the population, which on every census identifies itself as Native American, right? American Indians. The reason is asinine, because they identify with the oppression suffered by the American Indians at the hands of Mondialisme, of America, of NATO, of global homo.
That's hilarious. There's a song on Leibach's NATO album, which is an adaptation of a song called Cherokee Reservation or Cherokee Nation, I think it is. And it's Eastern Nation. And it's hilarious because it works out so beautifully. And there's even a line, even though we wear suits and ties, we're still the red men deep inside. And of course, it's not the Indian red men. In this case, it's like the communist red men. But yeah, that's fascinating. I had no idea that was something more than just a Leibach meme.
No. It's real. You get Serbs who are whiter than me, blue-eyed, blonde, 6'3", whatever. And they look at you in the eye and they say, I'm an Indian. I'm an American Indian. I'm a Native American. By what metric are you? Well, I'm oppressed. And for decades, I just thought this is just Serbs being Serbs. You know, they are whimsical people when you really get to know them.
Until
a friend of mine who's a Marxist academic really put it into perspective for me when she said, well, Macedonians are not white. I'm like, are you kidding me? We're not white? But why are we not white? And she says, well, we've been oppressed, right? We've never colonized anybody.
Oh.
And I say to her, well, are the Turks white? Are the Arabs white? Are the Japanese white? Because they had massive colonial empires, you know? Well, if Macedonians are not white because we were colonized and oppressed, our colonizers and oppressors were Turks. Are they white? She stood there and started thinking and said, no, but it's only because they're Muslim. So this is actually what Marxists and liberals, I think, truly believe, that whiteness is oppression. And that as such, if whiteness is oppression, then the oppressed cannot really have whiteness, even though they are physically white. And because in Russian internal discourse, they are the oppressed by NATO, by whoever, by the Anglo-Saxons, then of course they're not white. So they will identify, as Yaki observed, with the outer revolt against European rule. Even though they are, an average Russian guy, he could be a direct descendant of Rurik.
Yeah.
Or any of the German aristocrats which ruled Russia, or even the Slavic peasants who are nevertheless white, doesn't make any difference. They could actually consider themselves non-white and be pro the non-white world out of genuinely felt solidarity. I would call it false consciousness, but I think that when you've been as mind-fucked as the countries of Eastern Europe into believing these Marxist/libtarded lies, at that point, truth and falsehood as concepts lose their meaning. So that's how you get, you know, 6'3" blonde, blue-eyed Serbs saying that they're American Indians and they're actually non-white.
So, Friedrich, do you have any experiences like this in your post-communist homeland? Are there any of your friends and neighbors who think of themselves as non-white or identify with the global South or anti-colonialism or anything like that?
Not a chance in hell. You know, on this topic, what Putin said in his discourse is not something new. I mean, I'm almost as old as Greg. I'm almost as young as Greg. And, you know, I grew up with this, right? So all the time in school, you know, American colonialism, Western imperialism, you know, just drummed in our heads continuously over and over and over. I mean, like, I think Tom Sunich mentions this in his book, that we grew up with the anti-fascist paradigm throughout our lives. It's not something new. So he just, when I read it, I couldn't believe my eyes, you know, that, I mean, at least he didn't even try to repackage it into a modern or postmodern garb, right? So he just took it from there and repeated it.
Yeah.
Which is completely crazy, you know? And
Who wrote it? Noam Chomsky? I mean, that's definitely my reaction too. Was this Noam Chomsky? But no, this is being touted as incredibly based because, he does throw a few crumbs to people who really, really hate trannies and pride parades. It's amazing to me how I do think that the intense Russia shills are collapsing. The numbers are collapsing, but they're really collapsing in on just like, it's just nothing but gay, 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 gay. Gay, 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 gay. Now, you really think that they believe that this is like the winning thing, that countries will ratify their own destruction just to avoid the plague of drag queen story hour. The way I put it at the beginning of this invasion was intentionally snarky, but it was like, you know, this is American nationalists to Ukrainians. Hey, remember the people who brought you the Gulag and the Holodomor? They're back to save you from drag queen story hour. That was marginal to their discourse at the time. It was there. I would hear it every time. But now it's just, it's central. It's front and center. Do they think this is a winning hand? I don't know.
What gets me is just, you. Like, imagine this. Somewhere on the globe, there was a battalion of white nationalists with sonarads on their uniforms fighting to protect their homeland. Well, you don't have to imagine it because it's happening.
It's real.
Right now.
Yeah.
It's been happening. What should we do about it? Oh, let's take the other guy's side. Like, come on, like, get it together. Like,
it's grew literally into a regiment. That's right? Like, it's a regiment now. It's not a battalion anymore.
Yeah, that's like a wet dream for a lot of guys on this side of things, right? That's like, we need a based in red pilled military. It's like, but you guys are rooting against them. Like, what's going on here? It doesn't take much, like, you know, it just common sense, like, to look at the situation. But you've got to do a bunch of mental gymnastics to be able to bring yourself around to being like, no, those are the guys we got to root against. Like,
come on. There's this guy who's sort of fallen silent. He was a more prolific commentator for a while. He went under the name Tom Stoffel. And he's married to a Jew and has 4 part Jewish kids. And yet he engages in the most paranoid discourse. And he really, really amused me when he thought that Kevin MacDonald and Jared Taylor, by talking about things like pathological altruism and stuff like that, were simply covering for the Jews. You know, they're trying to blame it on us, not the Jews. And the very idea that people could be so confused that they would accept an ideology that would militate against their own interests. he thought was prima facie absurd. And even talking about that possibility was akin to covering for the evil of the Jews. And yet here is a guy who is abdicating an ideology that would create, you know, he's like a neo-Nazi, and he's like totally anti-Jewish. And it's like, well, what about your own kids? Right? What about, he's actually saying, well, you know, I would accept that my own kids cannot enter the ethnostate or whatever, something like that. And I said, okay, so you have an ideology that would cause you to disown your own children. And you can't imagine that anybody sincerely has an ideology that would cause them to harm their own children or their own race, right? It's just so weird. This guy is just so weird. But it's a beautiful example of how people can, through confusion, get trained to militate against their own interests.
I don't know. He might be onto something, Greg. When I think of Kevin McDonald, I think of covering up for the Jews. And
yeah, serving. Kevin McDonald. He's like the leading Judeo apologist. He's covering for the Jews because he's trying to talk about
Kevin McDonald. Yeah, notorious Jew lover, Kevin McDonald.
Yeah. I mean, just on the face of it, it's crazy. But you know, any attempt to talk about the psychology of white people that in such a way that it would explain how we could sincerely accept ideas that militate against our own genetic interests, he thinks is covering for the Jews. And yet his case, you know, he's just like a beautiful example of how ideology will get you to disown your own family, right? Well, a lot of our people have been hornswoggled, I think, with this Russia thing. They're actually profoundly worried about Putin. Oh, I hope Putin's doing okay today. What can I do to help? I'll get on the internet and say things, right? They sincerely believe that they're affecting this somehow. And they root against, and they don't just root against, they denigrate. They say vicious things about people that they should be bowing down and kissing their feet. You know, these Ukrainian nationalists, I've met many of these people. These people are amazingly impressive people. You know, Azov started out as a group of Russophone. Their first language is Russian. They're from Kharkiv in the east. They're ethnically Ukrainian and ethnically Russian. Their primary language is Russian. They started out as soccer hooligans, a group of soccer hooligans. And unlike most soccer hooligans in the world, in fact, I think unlike any other soccer hooligans in the world, somehow they built around this core a military group that then became part of the official military. It was a militia, then it became part of the official military. Then it spun off a political party, and it's now a movement that encompasses a huge amount of the ultra-nationalist right in Ukraine. How did this happen? Well, because its leadership is extremely intelligent and hardworking. You can't accomplish anything in this world that remarkable from such minor, humble beginnings without being extremely intelligent and hardworking. And I have to give them credit. They've been enormously successful as an organization. And
Had the good fortune of having the 2014 conflict as the stage on which they could shine. I'm reminded of the first line of the Ukrainian Nationalist March, we were born in a great hour, right? So it's important that your time come, and that when it does come, you are prepared to seize the moment. And from what I understand, the history of Azov Regiment is these guys seized the moment when they could have.
Yeah, they seized the moment. The thing is that any kind of political progress is a product of two factors. One is the objective conditions, the moment, and the other is your human quality, your organizational quality, etc. And they had the opportunity, and they had the human capital and organization to actually capitalize on it. So I respect these people enormously. And the people who say, oh, they're doomed, the West will destroy them. Well, again, I come back to this. If Azov is going to be destroyed by Globo Homo, then the National Justice Party doesn't have a chance. None of us have a chance. If these people are doomed, then we have no chance. I think that that is a terrible corner you're painting yourself into verbally. And for what? Rendering verbal help to Russia? I mean, again, talking about this isn't going to change the war. It only changes us.
That's a point that Mark brought up in the debate. He said, he talked about the Iron Curtain and the countries, you know, on the eastern side of the Iron Curtain aren't as paused as the countries on the western side. He framed it as like a blow against Globo Homo or whatever, you know, like that's why Russia needs to win. But what I guess he didn't think about it. I mean, Azov was, they're from a part of the world where the Iron Curtain was, right? They're ultra-nationalist. And, you know, Reuben Kalev, he's from behind the Iron Curtain. So it's like all these conservative and traditionalist societies are from behind the Iron Curtain too. That wasn't like a point in his favor. And all these people are saying the same thing. Like, you know, this invasion's bad. Reuben Kalev and Azov are fighting against, you know, the Russian invasion. So it's like, it's sort of a point. It goes against his point a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is just this astonishing narrative. And I know a lot of people who've said this, people I respect, Jonathan Bowden said this, you know, they noticed that these countries in the East were full of stubbornly sensible people. And instead of saying, in spite of the fact that they lived under communist totalitarianism and this crazed irrational system, and they still have these remnants of these communist mafias running some of their countries into the ground, despite all that, these people are still remarkably healthy. They say something very bizarre, which is to laud the socially conservative nature of Stalinism. That's just crazy talk to people who actually suffered under Stalinism. And it makes Western nationalists who say this literally sound crazy to people who are in the East. No, this wasn't a socially conservative system. This was profoundly destructive in its intention. It might have been inefficient in carrying it out in some ways, but God knows they tried, you know. They could arrest and intern and kill exactly as many people as they wanted, but it's not a virtue of communism. We shouldn't be praising communism for the endurance of the people who suffered through it and came out the other side. That's all I can say.
I mean, this myth is completely disconnected from reality. I mean, the only point where this could actually have some traction is that the East kept homosexuality illegal for longer than the West. This is the only point of truth, which in the long term, really, it's irrelevant, because we have suffered the exact same fertility depression as the West, in many cases worse, because we suffered the whole destruction of family and church. And you could say that religion and family have been deconstructed more thoroughly in the East than the West. That is really the long and short of it, right? Family, church, nationhood, maybe to a lesser degree, deconstructed, but ultimately Eastern societies, and I think Friedrich can say here, Romania in particular had its familial and religious institution destroyed by the Ceausescu regime. You know, my mother, she had to be baptized in secret. She couldn't be baptized in a church, because otherwise my grandfather would have been fired from his position. He was at the time commercial director of a mine. Why? Because if you are anybody in the industrial hierarchy, you're not allowed to have a religion. You're not allowed to be religious. You have to be an atheist. You have to be a communist. And so my mother, she was not baptized in a church. what happened was this: the priest secretly came, he changed into civilian clothing, got into the house and privately baptized my mother. This is the reason. My father, because his family was more connected, more elite, he was not even baptized. My father was baptized when he was 30 years old, right? You could not practice Christianity. It was frowned upon. You could not even practice Islam. It was frowned upon. All of these religions strongly frowned upon, especially if you were ruling class. And this has, and that's not to say nothing about the fact that you had infiltration of the churches, right, by counterintelligence, by state security. Mm-hmm. You can never really be sure in the East whether the priest you're talking to and maybe confessing to and taking communion from, participating in liturgy with, is he a man of God or is he a man of the state? Is he a, does he glow in the dark, or is he
the halo of sanctity, right?
Or does he have the halo of state security? It leads to paranoia in the believers. It leads to paranoia. My grandmother, she's a little paranoid about priests. She insists that they are young. She will not talk to any priest who's older than 50 or 40, I think, precisely because she's convinced that they're all commies.
That's interesting. So let me ask you, this idea that Vladimir Putin is a pious Orthodox Christian in the old Russian tradition, how credible is this? Because this is part of his positive image in the West. I'm sure Nick Fuentes thinks he's a Christian, upright Christian. Many people laud him as a Christian. Mark Collett was name-checking Christianity amongst the things that he stands for. How credible is it that an officer of the KGB was in any sense Christian? Friedrich, do you want to go first and then Nick?
Yeah, but so as Nick said just before, right? I mean, like, this was common knowledge. It was assumed that all the priests were secret police officers. It was like a trope, right? So people were going to church, but, nobody trusted them. And I suspect it was the same thing in Russia, right? I mean, I think a few years ago it was revealed, or maybe many years ago, that the patriarch, whatever his name was, he was like a KGB general or something, if I'm not wrong. Of course, I cannot know what is in Putin's mind, but, it doesn't seem very credible. And it seems more like a device to, get the trust of the people who are making more popular.
Yeah. Nick, what do you think about this?
No officer of the KGB would be baptized. Like, okay, so my father, his parents, my grandmother, she was chief of staff of the CEO of a very important company in Macedonia, right? And pretty early on joined the Communist Party because all of her brothers fought in the communist guerrilla. They were partisans. She never even thought about baptizing my father or his sister, my aunt, but they were not top commie apparatchiks, right? They're still in the commercial industrial aspect of the state, right? Not ruling class. Okay. I have a great uncle who was a Supreme Court president. So maybe I am ruling class in that sense. But my father was not baptized, and he was baptized in 1990. This was already, communism is unraveling, and he's already an adult. So he made this conscious choice when he was 30 years old or 29, I forget. So if the same rules applied in Russia, and they didn't, the USSR was far stricter than Yugoslavia about these things. There's no way that Putin was baptized before 1991. And I further do not think that he would have had the loyalty of his old KGB and Staatssicherheit friends, because he's also friends with his colleagues from the time in Dresden, if he had been baptized into Christianity. these guys, I don't think they have anything resembling what Westerners will think of as Christian faith. And a very little of that exists in the East, least of all in these post-communist ruling classes, right? So just from the limited experience, and of course, I have no insight into Christianity as it was practiced in the Soviet Union, because I've never really been to the Soviet Union or Russia. But if my experience here and my family's experience under communism is anything to go by, there is no way that Putin was baptized as a child, or that he had this sort of deep religious faith at any point before 1991. After that, I doubt it. Russia does not, it does not act as a Christian power, right? I don't know how to put this, but the culture of Russia is not the culture of a Christian nation. None of the Western cultures really are the cultures of Christian nations, because these are atheist nations, irreligious, secular nations. So is Russia. Russia is a secular nation. It has abortion. Furthermore, the culture as promoted by the state is antinatal. It's deeply antinatal. It's trying to get Russians to focus on their senses, on hedonism of some sort, in order to depoliticize them further. Because fundamentally, Russia, like America, considers its white population to be the number one threat. And this is why, I mean, E. Michael Jones, for all of his flaws, he's right about this. The regime in the West, it's trying to get you to coom, to masturbate and eat yourself into oblivion, because that way you're less of a threat. You cannot organize, you cannot notice something is wrong. Just smother yourself in this hedonic pleasures. There is a media campaign in Russia to focus you on hedonism. You know, look up to the mafia guy, want to be him, want to be the guy fucking the fake gypsy blonde with the plastic tits. But no, this is not what a Christian nation, a Christian state would propagate. Even if it were secular and Christianity had a good standing, I don't think they would have that in their media signaling.
Right. Well, I am conking out, guys. So I probably should wrap up, but I have enjoyed this. Thank you so much for joining me. But I think there's been a lot of substance to this, and I very much appreciate you helping me out. So before we go, though, let's just go around the room one more time. Friedrich, well, how about yourself? Any final thoughts on this? Any positive lessons? Any final impressions you want people to take away from this?
My main concern, you know, in light of the fact that for 250 years we have been losing, right? My main concern is with unity. And, you know, I was glad to see that despite the abrasive nature of some of the, you know, of Mark, right? And he seemed to cool down at the end and realize that, you know, that this is not very productive. I presume to have read his mind, but this was my impression. I mean, and probably you'll hear from him, you know, in the next days. And one more thing, I'm sorry I didn't come up with this. I think it could have helped if you mentioned Belarus, right, which is a client state of Russia. Belarus, which is sending, well, has been sending for, I don't know, I guess more than a year, like Africans into Poland and Western Europe and stuff like that. Like,
oh, yeah. I should have mentioned that.
Yeah. And my main concern is with unity. I hope we'll manage to get over something that we didn't need in the end, but you know, this is life.
Yeah, well, thank you. I do think it's an important issue. Again, there are two reasons I comment on this crisis, this issue. One is because I would like to get ethno-nationalism out there as an alternative paradigm for a better world. But the other reason I comment on this is to push back against what I think is subversion and corruption. And I'll call it cuckoldry too. What is cuckoldry, literally speaking? Well, when the cuckoo lays its egg in the other bird's nest and the cuckoo chick hatches, you have these little birds valiantly bringing worms to the nest to feed somebody who's not their own flesh and blood. They're taking resources from these other birds, starlings or whatever, and you get these cuckoos, which are sometimes as chicks bigger than the adult birds that are feeding them. And it's this utterly grotesque spectacle of biological parasitism. Well, this takes place in the human realm too. It takes place in the ideological realm. And what I have seen, and I've seen this now since 2013, is a massive effort on the part of Russia to subvert Western nationalists and to cuckold them so that Western nationalists spend their scarce time and resources, and their scarce human and financial capital, on pushing forward pro-Russia memes and arguing for things that advance Russian imperial interests on the world stage, as opposed to dealing with white interests. And it's a grotesque spectacle. It's a grotesque spectacle. It's the same spectacle as the giant cuckoo chick being valiantly fed by birds that are half its size who are mistaken into thinking that this is their baby, right? Russia is a vast power, and we have these tiny white nationalists who have marginal power, no money, et cetera, limited time, valiantly feeding our resources into the maw of this thing. And for what? What does this accomplish for Russia exactly? I don't know. What does this accomplish? Do the Russians think that having greasy basement-dwelling, pizza-faced neats memeing, frantically for their invasion, that this is going to change the world? I guess that's what they think. I think it's worth trying. I guess they think it's worth trying. But I don't think it's kind of cute that they want to deceive us and get us on board. But unfortunately, we have bigger things to worry about, better things to worry about. We have to worry about the future of a race, and we're not advancing our race's interests by shilling for Russian imperial revanchism. I'm sorry. I don't care how many degrees of chess you think that you're playing. Throwing aside our principles when all we got are principles, and immolating our credibility when all we've got is credibility, is going to get us to the world that we want. So I just don't see how that's going to happen. It's not in the cards, and it's a shocking form of spiritual cuckoldry that's taking place, and I want to push back against it. And I've been successfully, slowly, but successfully pushing back against it for a long time now, the better part of a decade.
That one piece about Dugin, where you compared him to an American professor, that's from 2013, you've been saying the same thing. So it's not like, like the narrative from the other camp of this side or whatever is saying, it's like you've been saying the same thing for nigh on 10 years now. So it's not like.
Yeah. Yeah. And guess what? No briefcases full of cash have ever appeared. I had a lunch with a Eurasianist influencer. And at a certain point, he declared, briefcases full of cash can appear if you help Russia or Iran. And I just thought, yeah, this is delusional. Yeah, right. But I've seen changes in behavior on people, on the part of people in the nationalist right, that make me wonder if they've fallen for this scam too. I don't think any briefcases full of cash have ever materialized or ever been exchanged.
You get accused of calling people, being on Russia's payroll or whatever. That was sort of an accusation. Yeah,
Mark was saying that. Stryker says that. I haven't actually accused anybody of saying that. There are people there are people in the Thule-tide camp who will come out and say that. And they do have some circumstantial evidence. I don't think you can pin it on people based on circumstantial evidence. But I do know for a fact that people at least drop hints that this is possible. And I also know that within the Trad Worker Party, of course, core people in that are now in NJP, and also in Richard Spencer's circle, of course, one member of that is in NJP too. That was the water cooler consensus, that if they went hard and shilling for Putin, that somehow Gazprom money would be sluiced into the pockets of American dissidents. I don't think it ever happened, but I know for a fact that in those two groups, people fervently believed that. And I, like I said, I was there at the lunch when this guy sort of airily alludes to this. And it's like, yeah, right. But I thought, okay, this might be the first glowy that I've ever met, or the first glowy I ever caught on to, put it that way. I thought, okay, this glows and I'm picking up my own lunch and I'm not picking up his. You know, if I were to meet Alexander Dugin, I could sit down and have coffee with him, but I would be violating U.S. federal law if I bought him a cup of coffee. As soon as this thought crossed my mind, I said, okay, we're going Dutch here.
I speak for myself, and I'll speak on behalf of the schizo faction when I say I'm not accusing anybody of, you know, anything, showing, taking money or whatever, but there's a couple websites out there that look strikingly familiar to each other. So, I mean, you've got that. So it's not like there's nothing. There is like a little bit of evidence there. And what are we just supposed to ignore it or whatever, you know? So, but I don't even care really. It's just one of those things that, like, you know, oh, you're a bad guy because you notice things or whatever. It's like,
yeah,
I don't know. It's kind of a low blow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if it's true and it's important, then we shouldn't be afraid to point these things out. And, if these people are being falsely accused, they should at least know that there's an appearance of impropriety. Right. In the case of Nick Griffin, I mean, Nick Griffin publishes on Sputnik. Nick Griffin, the former head of the BNP, somebody was an associate of Mark Collett for years before Mark and everybody else around him fell out with him. Griffin, he's literally a paid propagandist for Russia at this point, and there's practically nothing else that he does. So there are people who do this in our circles. And again, it's a grotesque spectacle of a tiny starved movement starving itself to feed the giant Russian cuckold chick that's been foisted upon us. For what purpose? It doesn't help Russia any, and it sure as hell doesn't help us. And I'm so tired of it.
Yeah, I'm tired of it being the current thing too. I'm ready to make the great replacement the current thing for, you know, until it's turned around, you know?
Yeah. I want to get back on that, but I want to get back on it with more people on the right on point with me rather than people wasting their time with Russian cuckoldry operations. So, but yeah, I'm still writing the book, The Great Replacement, and that's my big focus in the long run. But this has been a sideshow. It's been a shocking sideshow, a tragic sideshow. I feel strongly for the Ukrainians. I think this is a great opportunity for us to argue for the relevance of our points, and also to just reflect on how easily movements like ours can be subverted by people who have absolutely different interests in mind.
I don't think there's a lot of Russian money in the movement. I do think, however, that there are a lot of people who are mind fucked by what is Russian signaling specifically towards the West. I don't like it, for example, when people call Dugin, oh, he's Putin's brain. More specifically, I suspect that he is the guy in charge of signaling to dissident groups in the West. Like, his father was Russian military intel, so GRU, Dugin's father. When these things, they tend to run in the family. They tend to be hereditary. Maybe it's genetic. And from what I understand, this guy hits his mission in life to get Western dissidents from the right to support Russia. I don't think he uses a lot of money to do that. I think he uses a lot of diplomacy. I think he uses a lot of what I like to call mind fuckery. So maybe there's a promise of hypothetical Russian support at some far point in the future. But in reality, I think that Thultide overestimates the volume of money moving from Russia to the West for the purposes of shilling, and underestimates the ability of Russia to mindfuck Western dissidents. This is not new, right? We know that Russia has had Western-facing propaganda for a long time. What's new is that for the first time, I think they're trying to co-opt the nationalist-aligned right. However, I'll give a caveat here. Within the nationalist right, within people who are white nationalists, white identitarians, the split is more or less even, half for Russia, half for Ukraine. In the alt-light, however, in the MAGA-tard, the near-reactionary camps, it's all Russia all the time. And it's not even sort of a resigned, oh, we're isolationists, let the Slavs fight over the steppes. It's no, Russia is good, Ukraine is evil, Russians are liberators, Ukrainians are fascists, Putin is God's right-hand man, Zelensky is an evil Satanist. Russian propaganda has moved on from calling Russians, Ukrainians Nazis to calling them Satanists now. So, you know how that goes. I've heard some pretty, the most ridiculous stories about Russia, the Russo-Ukrainian wars I've heard come not from this space, they come from MAGA, from alt-light, and from conservative slash frog Twitter spaces that, oh, Biden had $8 billion in gold in a basement in Ukraine, and that the Queen of England died because they ran out of adrenochrome to extract from the children in the Donbass, which Ukraine was shelling, because apparently bombardment with artillery is the most efficient way to extract adrenochrome, or so I've been told. So I mean this whole attempt to destabilize Western countries, I don't know if it's ridiculous or insidious, because let's not fool ourselves. Our sphere is, in the intellectual world, very influential. Every other political faction is playing catch up with white identitarians. Everyone else is just lagging 2, 3, 4 years behind us. What was the alt-right platform in 2016 is the GOP platform today. Now, it's not enough, it never was enough, and we should not stop being radical, but we may be small, but we are, oh, we are the pea which discomforts the great princess of the West, and we're going to have to keep on being that.
Well, I agree with that, and in the long term, I think that we can turn the world around. It's just in the short term. I don't think that signaling one way or another on social media is really going to change the outcome of this war. But clearly, there are some people who very strongly believe that and want to dominate our thinking. I wish they would go away, because we have more important things to talk about. And maybe that's the resolution of this conversation. It's like, I've had my say on this. I've said my piece. I could tinker around with it for weeks and days and add little nuances and stuff, but it's not that important. Diminishing returns, et cetera, et cetera. I've said my piece. I want to go on. I want to go back to working on the Great Replacement, because, you know, I lament the fact that there are many good people in our movement who have been diverted from the real battle by the Russians. But I have been diverted from the real battle by the Russians by commenting on it past a certain point. I think I have to say my say on it to some extent and put people on notice that I think this is what's going on, and get that meme circulating, get that thought in people's minds. But then beyond that, I just need to get back to it. And we all need to get back to it if we think that we've adequately informed people about the danger of this. So anyway, that I think that's a good way of ending. And guys, thank you again for coming on board. Thank you for the moderators. You've had about 70 people for this impromptu stream. I very much appreciate it. Of course, there'll be some thousands who will listen to it when it pops up at Countercurrents next week. And I'm looking forward to coming back with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. Now, a week from today, Millennial Woes will be taking over the show because I will be traveling and unavailable to do Countercurrents Radio. But 2 weeks after that, I will be back with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. So thank you all very much. And I'm looking forward to talking to you again.
Cheers.
Take it easy. We're going to win.
Good night. Thank you.